Saturday morning to you. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall, along with Beth Guggenberger.
Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
Good
3 weeks in a row, you're here in the studio. That's a good thing for me.
It is a great thing.
It is a good thing.
It's really fun. It's fun to be here. It's the summertime. It's like, you know, if you're going to be in the Midwest, in my opinion, after having lived so many years in Mexico, you come in the summertime.
Yeah.
Sun shines.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather be here in spring. It gets a little, you know, it gets a little stuffy. But hey, who am I?
It's never good enough for you. Here's what I remember my dad
spring
always
is good enough for me.
Convertibles growing up. And this is the time of the year when you just had it down all the time and you went and got ice cream cones and you just never brushed your hair. And I just, I loved it. I loved it. I loved this time of year.
You never brushed your hair.
No, not with you.
That's a powerful memory of summer. You never
it
had to
is.
Brush your hair.
Never. I remember, I mean...
I think that's a girl thing.
Our authors, I mean, our listeners certainly know that our ages, since we bring it up all the time. So, I'd say 25-ish years ago, when laying out was a big part of my summertime.
Right.
You know, you put, like, Crisco, essentially, on your skin.
Yes.
And you just didn't, you put sun in your hair.
Right.
And you drove your convertible, so...
That's
you know.
Right. And you laid out on a blanket that was made of reflective material.
I mean, just might as well fry me up.
Every possible thing to do wrong was part of our normal summer routine.
I'm not even sure I wore my seatbelt in that convertible. We are a much better
That's
culture
exactly
today.
Right. We're a little bit safer than we were before.
For better or worse.
You know, it is summertime, just the beginning of... summer right after graduation, and I know that you recently spoke at your alma mater's high school graduation.
I did. You know, I hadn't been there in a really long time, and I mean, like 2 decades, a long time. And there were a few remaining teachers. There were a few current faculty that were, you know, students when I was a student. It was just, you know, a little like doo 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 doo, like only whatever that is. It's a public school, and one thing I like is that it has a believing administration, and they were very open to me being open about my life in that environment, which I'm not sure how many of our listening audience and what parts of the country they live, but you can't do that everywhere. But here we are in the Midwest, you can still talk about
that. Yeah, usually the headlines are about not being allowed to do those kind of things,
I mean,
the administration at this school was like, yeah, hey, why not?
Yeah.
And what a difference. I mean, when it's not that long ago, but when you went to this particular high school here in town, it was in the middle of absolute nowhere. It's kind of grown up since then. It was sort of like the country school almost back in the day.
He's like my husband. My husband went to my high school prom with me, and they played one Garth Brooks song, and he has been spending 2 decades talking about how I went to a country school. I did not go to a country school.
I moved to Cincinnati when you were in high school, right? I was not in high school. I was just a little bit beyond that. And this high school where you grew up was...
It was not.
It was out in the sticks.
Todd always tells my kids, the boys all had mustaches. I'm like, no,
yes.
One maybe had a mustache.
Yes.
No,
yeah.
No.
Anyway, but anyway, did it go well? Was it fun? And
it was. It was fun. And you know what I like the best is that families gather together. They celebrate each other. They celebrate the students. The students are thinking their whole lives ahead of them. My message was all about living outside of the box, dreaming big dreams, believing in what it is that God might still have for you out there, and knowing that the best is yet to come. And
it'll be an interesting topic with one of our guests today, who is Christina Ellis. She's written a book called Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, The Secrets That Helped Me Win $500,000 in Free Money for College. An interesting part of her story, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit in the next segment, is she wasn't the greatest student. She didn't have the greatest test scores.
Mm-hmm.
All those things that we sort of check the boxes like, ooh, when you graduate, you better have this, you better have that. I think she went to Vanderbilt.
I mean,
we're talking like Vanderbilt, top 20 university. And so...
Yes, and I think to myself, you with your PhD education, Mr. Symposium Attender all the time, you've got to know, as well as the rest of us, that good grades are not always indicators of lifetime success, or even collegiate success.
Right.
And yeah, I think Christina Ellis probably has a lot to share with us about who it is that she believed in and what she thought she was capable of.
Absolutely, and so it's not too late if your son or daughter just graduated. It may be right about to be too late, but if you got younger kids or grandkids or something like that who you hope to go to college and may not have the means, or you're worried about them not having the pedigree, you know, their GPA and all that stuff, a great book, and I'm sure, I know it's going to be a very interesting interview to talk to her about that.
I know, looking forward to that.
Hey, I wanted to bring up something that's a few weeks old by now, but, you know, you and I talk all the time. We just don't talk on Saturday morning when we're here. We talk all the time.
We have conversations that inspire our day.
we do. You went to Nashville a few weeks ago.
Yes, I did.
And there was a Summit of the Orphan there.
Yeah.
And you've just been telling me so many cool stories about it. And so I didn't want to any further away from that conference without prompting you to share some of those stories with the people who are listening.
I mean, the first thing, there were almost 2,700 people that gathered in Nashville for the 9th Annual Summit of the Orphan. And the first thing you notice when you pull into the parking lot, besides that Tennessee has a lot of big churches, is that that there were so many enormously large cars, you know, like, because you walk in and this is the kind of place where families, you know, I have 9 children. I said I had 9 children. There was no one in the room that blinked.
Okay, cool.
I got 17. I got 23. I got,
right.
You know, how many colors are your kids? You know, there were,
right.
like, so many like-minded people in one space. And they had this one particular family that got up on stage, the Wagner family. You can look them up on YouTube. They have some great material out there. But they have a biracial family, so they have several adopted children that are African-American, a couple. They have a hearing-impaired child, a child that's restricted by a wheelchair. It's just like a really creative way they have built their family, 9 kids. But their kids are all adults now. So with the maturity that time and experience came, they were beginning to unpack what it was like to grow up in a family like theirs. The dad was a fireman, you know, they lived in a middle-class community, just a regular old family. And one of the men, his name was Dominic, he was in his mid to early 20s, and he said on Heritage Day, when he was in, like, 5th or 6th grade, his teacher was really excited because she'd been kind of curious about his heritage, wanted him to come in with heritage food and heritage dress.
Yeah.
He's like, I wore a Denver Broncos jersey, and I brought Rice Krispie treats because my dad's a Broncos fan, and that's what we ate at my house.
Right.
He went on to kind of debunk this very controversial theory that when we have adopted children, we need to highly emphasize their home culture in order for them to feel value. And he said something that just feels like common sense to me, where he was saying, the most important culture to emphasize is the culture of your home. That I felt like a Wagner more than I felt like anything else. And as a result, he's a seemingly well-adjusted adult who understood his value in that family unit and then in his larger world. And I thought to myself, wow, that was a very bold statement to say in a setting like that, where there are people who believe that we have to protect a child's home culture.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, I'm certainly not as into the culture as you are of adoption, but I do know enough to know that that is kind of an ongoing debate about, do you emphasize the culture from which your adopted child or children come from? So an interesting.
It was a conference full of debate.
I love that.
There's a conversation these days in the mission world about short-term mission trips and the value, and we've had some of those folks on the air, the Wind Helping Hurts and Toxic Charity and We Are Not the Hero. And I presented a conference called Restoring the Reputation of the Short-Term Mission Trip, and it was the air was electric because it's not something that everybody anymore believes in. And to be able to, I got up and said, hey, I don't have all the answers, but I'm willing to be a lightning rod for the conversation.
Yeah, let's not chuck this out just because it's sort of like a popular topic. Let's really dig into it a little
bit. I should have brought the radio with me and we could have done a session right there.
Right? You need to include me in these things.
We'll do it again.
Hey, we've got an interesting show today. Two very different authors, two very different stories. After the break, we're going to be talking to Christina Ellis, Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, The Secrets That Helped Me Win $500,000 in Free Money for College. So as an educator, I'm very interested in that conversation. But I've also been thinking, man, our last several shows have just been like, I mean, I get to be part of the conversation, but they have just been incredibly interesting shows for me to just listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're interested in those, right after listening to this show, you can go to BethGuckenberger.com.
Or while you're doing it, because we know how people are technologically multitasking.
You can go to BethGuckenberger.com. You can go to iTunes, and you can look for Real Life with Beth and Rob. You can look on Facebook, Real Life with Beth and Rob, or our own website, Real Life with Beth and Rob, and you can find the shows there. Some really great conversations, and so I want to steer people. You can join the now nearly 700,000 people who have downloaded a past episode by going there yourselves. So right after this break, we'll hit it up with Christina Ellis about her book, Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, and we hope that she'll be back with us in 60 seconds.
Who's Weaving Your Story? The Story Weaver series by Beth Guckenberger highlights the plight of orphans throughout the world in personal, heart-grabbing stories of loss, struggle, and redemption. the kind of redemption only God, the great story weaver, can accomplish. Written for ages 8 and up, Tales of the Not Forgotten and Tales of the Defended Ones reveal God's ability to create a story far greater than we can imagine. And the corresponding 6-part Leader's Guides on CD help turn each book's content into a simple yet powerful 6-week curriculum for any church or small group. Use both together and you have a 12-week curriculum full of fun activities, compelling stories, biblical teaching, and practical applications. Let God weave your story and see what He can accomplish for orphans worldwide. The Story Weaver series is published by Standard Publishing and is available at www.standardpub.com or your favorite Christian bookstore.
This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall, along with Beth Guckenberger on this Saturday morning. Beth, good morning.
This start to the summer, final high school graduation season, this is a perfect guest.
Perfect guest. And after reading through the book and I being in education myself, I'm like, this is going to be an interesting conversation. Christina Ellis is the author of Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, The Secrets That Helped Me Win $500,000 in Free Money for College. And instead of us telling you all about it, I'd much rather have Christina tell you all about it. So, Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's just jump right in. Tell us the circumstances behind why it is that you needed to win $500,000 in free money for college.
Well, my mom basically sat me down the first day of my freshman year of high school, and she said, I love you and I believe in you, but there is no way I can support you financially once you graduate from high school and you need to figure out a way to pay for college. You know, and my mom, she lost her husband to cancer. You know, we had really struggled financially. We dealt with poverty and just really a lot of obstacles. So I understood why she was telling me that. It was just still really hard to choke it down. But you know what? That was one of the greatest gifts my mom could have ever given me, because it lit a fire in me that day to figure out how on earth I was going to pay for college and to start looking around for scholarships and creating a roadmap to help me stand out.
Well, it's interesting, Christina. You know, you talk about in the book that, your resume, so to speak, wouldn't be the one that would normally be tied to a scholarship winner. But in your mind, there was no question you were going to go to college. I mean, you were driven to do that. How did you sort of overcome what might be seen as a lack of grades or test scores, the things that most people associate with college scholarship winners? How did you overcome that with your drive and desire to be a college student?
Well, I started thinking creatively and figuring out different ways to stand out. You know, that day, my freshman year of high school, when my mom sat me down, you know, at that point I had B's and C's, and I wasn't the greatest student. So I started thinking through, okay, what can I do to stand out from everybody else? I figured out that, you know, scholarship application judges love to see that leadership, teamwork, volunteerism, and different qualities in scholars that can show that they have the potential to stand out in the future. So I started really building up my credentials within leadership. And I actually have found that I fell in love with volunteerism. And I started volunteering in different places in our community. I created my own opportunities. I did missions work. And by the time I graduated from high school, I had logged over 1,000 hours of community service.
Wow.
And, you know, judges love to see that commitment and achievement. So I guess when I first sat down and tried to figure out how on earth to win scholarships, you know, I figured out that there are other ways to stand out other than just grades and just academics. And I started really working hard and applying those principles to my life. And in my book, Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, I teach students how they, too, can build up their credentials and their resume to also stand out themselves and win scholarships.
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, you think about this when you're 14. You're right, your mom did give you a gift by kind of serving that opportunity up to you on a platter. But is it ever too late for a student? If we have someone listening in the listening audience who's maybe has a 16, 17, 18-year-old, they're just now thinking about that. Is there ever kind of a threshold you cross and you miss out on these opportunities you were able to gain?
It's definitely not too late. You know, there are over 1.5 million separate awards given out every year. There's a lot of money out there if you're really willing to work hard and dig around and find the right opportunities for you. So definitely, you know, take the time to start looking around and figure out what fits. And there's also ways that if you're at that spot where you're, you know, in your junior or senior year and you're wanting to win scholarships, but you haven't had, you know, you didn't know to start building up your resume till this point. You know, I explain in my book different ways for students to, you know, build up their resume and polish it at the last minute so that they can still stand out and really have those credentials. I teach them things like gap fillers and creating their own opportunities that can help them, you know, fill in any gaps on their application, even if it's the last minute, so they can still stand out and win scholarships.
What kind of, you know, I think of most people like an academic scholarship, an athletic scholarship, and they kind of just lump it into one giant possibility. What kinds of scholarships did you receive?
I received all sorts of scholarships. I received some really great merit scholarships. I won the Coca-Cola scholarship, the national scholarship, which is one of the biggest merit-based scholarships in the nation. I was fortunate to be chosen as 1 in 50 scholars out of over 100,000 applicants. I felt very blessed to win that. And I won several dean scholarships and university-based scholarships, as well as a few need-based scholarships as well. So a good combination. You know, I really, really sat down and looked around at what scholarships fit me, and I applied to a ton of scholarships. I always tell students, you know, a lot of it is the multiplicity rule. You know, you want to apply to a lot of scholarships. You want to find those ones that really fit you and spend extra time on them. But, you know, you also want to put yourself out there a lot and increase your chances of winning. You know, a lot of the most successful scholarship winners got rejected for a few scholarships, myself included. So it's important to really put yourself out there and apply to a lot of scholarships, because even though I did get rejected a few scholarships, I still won over $500,000 in scholarships, which was more than enough to pay for my education.
Right.
And so you were just mentioning that you have to spend extra time on scholarships that really fit your profile. Like, that just begs to ask, like, how much time did you spend in that last year of high school really working on applications and essays and all of that?
I spent quite a bit of time. I really saw it as my part-time job, you know, and if you really think about it and break it down, that's a pretty excellent part-time job. You
know, 500 grand for part-time.
Right. So, I mean, I did spend, you know, at least a few hours a day sitting down and looking over my applications and, you know, getting teachers to review them. You know, I definitely looked at every detail of the application. You know, I had several teachers review them. I had people sit down and practice interviews with me, and really took each step in the process very seriously, which I think really, you know, it paid off, because, you know, I wanted to create as solid of an application as possible. So in my book, I really break down those steps for students and what I did and how I spent my time and the roadmap I found successful, so that they can, you know, not waste, you know, one thing I had to do is, you know, I didn't really have a very clear roadmap. You know, I read a lot of articles, I interviewed a lot of scholarship winners and programs, so a lot of my time did go to just trying to figure out what I was doing. So that's, you know, one of the big motivations for why I wrote my book, to help students save time and get straight to the point and figure out exactly what they need to do to stand out in the process, how to fill out the application, and how they can win.
You know, one thing I see a lot of time, I work in a school, I'm a school administrator, and one thing that I see a lot that initially students and their families might think works against them in the scholarship process might actually work for them. So being from a low income or poverty family, perhaps never having someone in your family who had gone to college before, a lot of families will see this as a negative. So I'm wondering if in your process you saw that as something that actually worked to your advantage.
Yeah, it did actually work to my advantage. You know, I have a chapter in my book called Telling Your Story, Painting a Picture with Your Words. You know, those essays are really an opportunity for judges to get to know you as a person and see your character. And just like anybody else, judges can fall in love with personal stories of triumph and how they overcame. And that doesn't mean you just tell the good things. You know, I did share with the judges, you know, some of the struggles I faced growing up and some of the challenges and the things that made me who I am, you know, and fortunately they could see, you know, that I worked really hard to get out of my situation and that I worked hard to build up my resume and credentials in spite of the, you know, struggles we were facing. And judges love to see that. And even if you're not in poverty, even if you're not, you know, struggling with that particular issue, you know, there are other personal stories you can share with judges.
Right.
You know, I actually have worked with a few students this year who shared, you know, one student lost their best friend in an accident, tragically, and that really impacted their life, and it really you know, impacted their perspective on how they treat other people and how they really cherish every moment. And they ended up winning a massive scholarship based on that story. And wow. I had another student who was in a wreck, and she was actually behind the wheel, and somebody died in her car. And, you know, it really impacted her as a person and changed how she viewed life. And she actually shared that story with the judges and won a really major scholarship. So, you know, whatever, you know, even if it's hard stuff that's impacted you and made you who you are, you know, you can share that with judges and let them know, you know, the story of you.
Right.
So who should exactly read this book, and what is kind of your number one take home? What would you want our listeners to know for sure about winning scholarship money?
Well, I wrote this book primarily for high school students. You know, it's a little bit different of a process for high school students than for adults, but a lot of the principles are the same. So if you are an adult wanting to win a scholarship, there's still a lot of principles for how to fill out scholarship applications and how to be successful in the process. You know, and I would just really tell people to commit to the process and go for it. There is money out there, and yes, it may take work and it may take some strategy, but the money is out there, and if you're willing to commit to the process, there's no reason why some of that money shouldn't go to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So where can people find it? Where can they find you?
Well, the book is available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and pretty much bookstores all around the country. And if you want to reach out and keep in touch with me, you can visit my website at ChristinaEllis.com. That's Christina with a K. And I'm also on social media. If you visit my website, I have links to all of my different social media pages. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Well, Christina, it's not only a practical book, but a very inspiring story. And so, college education now is just such an important thing. It is a timely book, and I'm really excited that we got a chance to share it with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you guys.
Absolutely. Blessings to you.
Thank you, and you too.
All right. Thanks for being on the show.
I was just thinking to myself, man, in this day and age when you hear regularly the rising cost of education, and it can feel daunting, and a student might think, I'm not, you know, a superstar athlete, and I don't have Rhodes Scholar grade, so what are my options? You know, I'm not a redhead, my parents aren't immigrants, like, you know, what in the world, what is out there for me?
And I'm not a redhead?
Haven't you ever heard about the redhead? There's a great scholarship.
In that long list, I'm like, I'm not a redhead.
Yes, I have a friend who won a great scholarship in high school for having red hair. But,
really?
Wow. Somebody has endowed the redhead in the world.
All right.
Anyway, if you think there's nothing that makes me stand out, she gives you inspiration that there is maybe something.
Yeah. I tell you, my son is graduating. Actually, just graduated. He's graduating. My son just graduated. He'll be off to the University of Kentucky next year. And we have gone through this process over the last couple of years, just the application process, all these. And to have a book, in addition to what I hope your guidance counselor at your school is doing or whatever, that allows you to say, well, how can I tap in? You know, these scholarships are not beyond my reach. All of those kind of things. It's an important thing for you and your family to get involved in.
And I like the idea that it's written to students. Like, dear parent, here's how you can get your kids some money.
Yeah, it's a guide for parents to help their kids.
Yeah, it's like, hey, kid, I think you have all the potential in the world to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
And you can take time to do it. You can do the research. You can ask a teacher. You can do the interview, you know, practice. You can consider this your part-time job.
Yep, and we will link to that on our website, which is reallifewithbethandrob.com. So you can go there and Confessions of a Scholarship Winner, Christina Ellis, it'll be right there. And after the break, we're going to be talking totally a shift, but I love that this part of the show. We can just talk about whatever we find interesting.
That's the kind of
So Finding My Voice, My Journey Through Grief to Grace by Nita Whitaker LaFontaine. It's a really an interesting read. It's an interesting story, another inspiring story, and so
we
like those. Whether it's about getting into college or moving from grief to grace, these are the kinds of conversations that just poke at us, and we want to continue to have long after the show is over. So, this is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall. That's Beth Buchenberger. Join us right after the break, and we'll be talking about Finding My Voice with Nita Whitaker LaFontaine.
Do you have have a family member who's getting older and can no longer be safely left alone? Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care, assists senior citizens and adults to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Visiting Angels has over 400 franchised locations across the nation. Experienced, compassionate caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meal preparation, and light housework up to 24 hours a day. Rates are affordable, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. Visiting Angels has cared for hundreds of thousands of seniors nationwide. Franchises are available. Call Visiting Angels toll-free today at 877-374-LIVE. To find an office near you, visit www.visitingangels.com. For home care for your loved ones, call Visiting Angels now at 877-374-LIVE. That's Visiting Angels, America's choice in home care, at 877-374-LIVE.
He found shelter under the rock and lay there looking at the stars. God, do you remember me? In Tales of the Not Forgotten by Beth Guckenberger, Joel dares to ask for what he can't have. Serafina sacrifices what she can't afford to give. Abram looks for an answer buried out of reach, and Christina, saved by a mission, searches for her own. Follow these life-changing stories as they take you on a journey to faraway lands and unfamiliar faces. Travel through their challenges and see the hand of the great story weaver writing endings you'd never imagine. These are the tales of the ones the world doesn't see, tales of the not forgotten. In Tales of the Not Forgotten, learn how God is the great story weaver, weaving the threads of our lives into a strong and beautiful sign of His love. Check out Tales of the Not Forgotten book and missions materials by Beth Guckenberger. For more information or to purchase, go to your local Christian supplier or visit standardpub.com. See lives transformed.
If becoming or staying debt-free is important to you, you're not alone. 10 years ago, I was worried sick, overwhelmed with debt, and so tired of not having enough at the end of the month to make ends meet. I was working a full-time job, but getting deeper in debt every month, and I hated being away from my children. I finally said, that's enough, and I made a decision to do whatever it took to get free from the terrible debt that was causing me so much stress. I'm Gina Neef, and I want to invite you to find the same financial freedom that I found. Not only did I pay my way out of debt, I was also able to leave my corporate job and work from home and be completely available to my family. For years now, I've worked part-time hours, making more than a full-time job would ever pay. I remember the pain of being in over my head, and I'll never forget the joy of becoming debt-free. That's why I show others how to do the same. If you're ready to work from home and find financial freedom, then I'm eager to show you how. Go to findingfreedomnow.com. Discover how you can get free from debt. Go to findingfreedomnow.com.
Last October, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to Nigeria, where I had a chance to meet the boy I sponsored through back-to-back. The moment I met him, it became real that Jeremiah was not just a boy in a picture. He was a boy with dreams, hopes, and a story just like my own kids. At that moment, I saw how back-to-back is changing the lives of orphans around the world. I realized that in the same way I'm here for my children to be part of their stories, I can also be part of Jeremiah's. In the same way that my children can be a brother or sister to each other, they can care for Jeremiah. They can write him letters and share their stories as they grow up. We can help him to receive an education and food to fill his stomach, but more importantly, we can be involved in his life and encourage him to follow his dreams. I learned that sponsoring a child through back-to-back is not just about financial support for an orphan. It is about allowing God to intertwine your story and your heart with a child in need. For more information on sponsoring an orphan like Jeremiah through back-to-back, contact 513-754-0300 or email at childsponsorship@back2back.org.
This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall, along with Beth Guckenberger, on what I hope, sincerely, is
a fantastic Saturday.
A glorious Saturday morning for all you people out there. Hey, you know, one thing that we're doing here, and we try to do in spring, summer, you know, as summer rolls around, is we want to give people things to read. Because usually in the summer times, things slow down a little bit for most people. They find themselves hanging by the pool.
We like picturing you all hanging out at the beach.
Someplace, front porch, maybe relaxing on the couch, reading a good
habit.
Reading a good book. And so, obviously, during the first segment, we offered a book that you should buy for your kids.
I mean,
right?
a good summer read for your high school students.
Confessions of a Scholarship Winner. If you have high school students especially, buy it for them.
Yeah.
This book, however, probably might be more
For the adult.
For the adult. And so it is really a touching memoir. It's more than anything else. Finding my voice, my journey through grief to grace, living with the loss of Don LaFontaine. Nita Whitaker LaFontaine, the author, and she's joining us here this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be with you today.
You know, one thing that a lot of people might not know, just by the title of the book, that you kind of hobnob in some places. This is not just a book about the loss of Don LaFontaine, but you kind of hobnob with some pretty famous people yourself. Stevie Wonder, Josh Groban, Michael Bublé, Barbara Streisand. I mean,
Celine Dion.
I feel like I'm name-dropping when I name those wonderful people that I've had the blessing to have crossed their paths. But, yes, I consider many of them my friends.
Well, the good news is I got the name drop for you, so you didn't have to. So it begs the question, I mean, how did you get involved with a group of friends like that?
Well, my association probably began after Star Search. I was a female grand champion. And from that, through my publicist, I met a series of people. One of those people was David Foster, and I mm-hmm. began to do some work with him back in the mid-90s. And from there, because of his association, I ended up connecting with quite a few people. The first one would be Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston on The Bodyguard. I was in that movie. I sang the demos for Whitney for two or three of the songs. I Will Always Love You and I Have Nothing. And then I began performing different places and ended up being on stages with those people that you aforenamed. And Josh Groban I met him when he was 17, and we began doing some charity work with David and some live work with David. For two or three years, we did gigs with David together, so he became my friend, and as well as Michael Bublé. So I met those. I would say David Foster's been a big conduit for those connections.
And Michael Bublé wrote the foreword to your book.
Yes, he did, and I sang at his wedding in Argentina.
Wow.
Yeah. Not everybody can say that.
Yeah, I don't know anybody other than Anita can say that.
And if I might say, it was quite a wedding. Oh, my gosh, it was so amazing.
I bet it was. That's a different show. We'll have to talk about that another time.
Well, that's a different show, exactly.
Yes.
Well, you know, lovely being.
Yeah.
That's a great shout-out. Well, the subject of your book, of course, is about the grief and loss of what it was like to love a man and then to lose him. So will you just tell us a little bit, our listening audience, about your love story? How is it that you met Don, and how did your paths get crossed?
Don and I were both drawn to Los Angeles because of the work we dreamed of doing with our voices. Don came to begin what he thought was going to be his own trailer company because he had worked for Paramount Pictures and had been the vice president of advertising. I left my community and safety of Louisiana in person, leaving my nursing career, actually I brought it with me, and in pursuit of a dream of singing for a living instead of nursing for a living. And we met in this faded, wonderful little room called the Rose Tattoo on a Sunday night where singers could get up and sing and be a part of a very small competition and win money and some recognition and maybe get an agent. Don was in the audience the very first time I sang in Los Angeles. I didn't know he would become my husband. I'm sure he didn't know I was going to become his wife. But we met, and 4 months later, he asked me out for a date, and we had a date, and I thought, he's a nice guy, but I don't want to get involved. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he was thinking the same thing. But anyway, we ended up falling in love with each other, and we courted for about a year and 9 months, and if I may say, he was the most romantic person I've ever met in my life. Very old school, light candles, have music, wine and dine. He just was, opened my door the 20 years of our marriage. He just was such a gentle man and was an adoring husband. But our voices are what brought us together. And the theme of our wedding, we called it One Voice because we felt like our voices were coming together to become one. This great harmony that we sang in together. So we had a beautiful love story. There were some challenges along the way. I wanted to be sure he knew I was a girl that had standards and morals, and there were some things that were in his life that were not okay with me at the time, and we had to deal with those things. But he rose up to be a man, and he presented himself like a playboy. You know, Don had blow-dried hair and a medallion and the unbuttoned shirt and the fast car and, you know, a little bachelor pad. I'm thinking, oh, I want nothing with this guy, you know. And then, but all of that melted away, and this beautiful man rose to meet me, because I think that was a facade. It really, who he was always this really kind, super generous man. And when I saw that, that's what I fell in love with.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
think the same with me. I was just sort of quite green, I may say, had a great naivete, but a heart, and I wanted to someone who shared the vision of having a life and a home and a family, and that was Don. And we had this wonderful, and not without issues. I don't want anybody to think that people have perfect lives. It's just not, that's not human. But we had a wonderful love story in that we had such great affection for each other. We laughed a lot, and it was not your traditional marriage. You know, I'm younger and taller.
And, we saw that. There's some great pictures in the back of the book, and it really does come out in some of those pictures.
Yeah, and the reason that I wanted to write the book was because it was a great love story. It was, we were our own Lauren and McCall, and it was one word, Don and Nita. It wasn't Nita. It was always just, we were such a pair. And everyone who knew us, the moment you met us, knew, oh, gosh, you're great together, because we really fit. We fit. We were much the same. We had the same spirit of generosity, the same love of our family. And we really defined ourselves more, not by the things in our career or accomplishments, but by how happy our family was. And that was really important to both of us.
I was going to ask, you know, for our listeners, you said the theme of your wedding was one voice. They may not know Don by his name, but they certainly would know him by his voice. Clue our listeners into why that would be. And he's got a really cool nickname, by the way.
Yeah, someone that I don't know who gave him that name, the King of Voiceovers. And I remember when I first met Don, I didn't know what voiceover was. After we'd been dating about 3 or 4 months, I said, so, what do you do? Because it's never about what you do, what car you drive. I wanted to meet a person. So I said, what do you do? He said, voiceover. I said, what's that? He said, voiceover sound. I said, what's that? He said, coming to a theater near you. Oh, that's you? And so I started to listen, because he had a very distinct way of speaking. Don was a voracious reader, and he was a wordsmith. If there was an S and a T and an S, he said all three. I can't do that. But he was the voice of more than 5,000 movie trailers and the voice of more than 750,000 radio and TV spots.
Wow.
And, I don't know who counted, but Guinness just did. He said, he's the guy.
Well, tell us a little bit about how long were you married before he received that cancer diagnosis?
We were married, we were into our 19th year, and he actually died 1 month before our 20th anniversary. We were together 22 years, but we got a diagnosis in January of 2008, and he passed away on September 1st of 2008.
Yeah. Are you able to join us after the break? Because I'd really love to get into some of the heart of the book. Are you able to do that?
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Hey, we're talking with Nita Whitaker LaFontaine, a great love story, Finding My Voice, My Journey Through Grief to Grace, Living with the Loss of Don LaFontaine. And, Beth, these are the best. You know, a lot of people love reading love stories. Right? The best love stories are the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a real love story. And so if you're looking for a book to read over the summer, you love reading about romance and love, and this is the kind of book you want. The best story is a real story. So we hope you join us after the break to talk about that.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, the best love stories, I mean, they come from a place where your expectation was one thing, and then God gave you so much more than you ever imagined, and where one and one equal more than two, and where, you know, those stories are full of the high and the low, and just even, she said it so quickly, that the transition from who he was when he met her to who he was when she married him. I mean, I think there's a lot of richness.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a lot about that and the grief to grace part when we get back. So come back right after the break. You're listening to Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall, Beth Kuchenberger, and we'll be back in just 60 seconds. Ooh, yeah.
This past summer, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to India, where I met a little girl named Shailaja from an orphanage with back-to-back. She was a new child at the home and was having a hard time adjusting. As I began playing with her and painting her nails, I was reminded that this little girl was just like my sisters back at home in the United States. Instead of a face on a photo, she became a part of my family when I realized that I could continue to help her through back-to-back's child sponsorship program. Even though she lives over 8,000 miles away, through the back-to-back sponsorship program, I can ensure that her spiritual, physical, educational, emotional, and social needs are met. The best part about the program is when I come home from school and find a letter from Shailaja. I am so thankful for God working within both of our hearts in order to lead us closer to each other and closer to Him. Visit www.backtoback.org for more information.
This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall along with Beth Kuchenberger. By the way, if you're looking for us, you can go to reallifewithbethandrob.com, find us on Facebook, you know, all the normal stuff. If you want to download some past shows, you can go to iTunes, all that. We'd love for you to, because our show, hopefully, is full of great conversations like the one we're having right now with Nita Whitaker LaFontaine. We're talking about her book. It's more a memoir, but Finding My Voice, My Journey Through Grief to Grace, Living with the Loss of Don LaFontaine. And in the last segment, Nita, we were talking about sort of how your love blossomed, how your relationship grew, and then right when we left, you told us that Don passed away just before your 20th wedding anniversary. Tell us a little bit about how you rebounded from that. Where did you draw your strength from during this journey and then after his death?
Well, I think it's so important to talk about this topic because I am not alone. I'm not the only woman who will have to stand beside a casket and bury the love of their life. And I think it's important that we discuss what it's like to walk through it. In doing so, we become wounded warriors, and in turn we become wounded healers, because by sharing our story we can help heal ourselves and heal others. So that's the purpose of writing this book. The road from grief to grace for me was netted by having the most incredible family who was supportive, having a faith, and having those wonderful two girls that whose faces I could look at and see their dad. It was probably the biggest source of me not staying in a hole of grief, which is very easy to do, and it's very comfortable to be there because you're sad, you're so wounded. I felt, and I mentioned in the book, I felt halved. I really felt like half of me was gone. We were such a pair. We were a duo. We discussed everything. We talked about, we made decisions together about what we were going to do and what trip we were going to take and what we were going to do with the kids and how we were going to discipline and what our strategy was, you know, what our next project would be. And that was suddenly gone. I didn't have that voice next to me. And when he was going through the process of making his ascension, I felt like my voice was gone because I so leaned on him. We were yin and yang. I leaned on him when he needed, and he leaned on me. And I had to figure out how to stand by myself and carry these girls forward. But the biggest factors for me were faith, which was huge. Prayer, I'm a huge believer in prayer. And family, I couldn't have gotten through it without someone sort of steering me. Because initially when you're in the depths of grief and in the hold of it, you don't know what to do. I couldn't really think of like normal things. I mean, I could, you know, brush my teeth and get up, but I had no direction to my day because my whole life pattern was thrown off by this event. And, you know, I had a house full of people there. There was people bringing food, and my sister would say, okay, you need to do this, you need to do that. And, okay, thank you. Cause I couldn't think for myself. And it was so great to have them as my guides and my shield from the world, because sometimes people call you and very meaning well, they would say, how are you? And I would say, I don't know. I don't know how I'm doing. What do you need? I don't know what I need. I'm just trying to be here and be sane. I have no idea. people will say things because they mean well. They don't know what else to say.
Right.
What do you
right.
need? I don't know what I need. I have no idea. This is all so new for me. And anyone can tell you who's walked this road. It is, until you're in it, you don't know the road. You don't know what to expect. You don't know how you're going to feel. You don't know how you're going to react. But the thing that kept me going was my children, my beautiful girls, who mm-hmm. in whom I knew was my charge to carry them onto their path. And if I fell apart and I stayed in the hole of grief and despair, I could lose them. They're also watching me. How does mom handle a hard thing? They're watching me, even though they didn't know they were. Because our children yeah. learn by what they see more than what we say. And so I knew they were watching me. And I knew that I had to be a source of strength for them, because if I fell apart, who was going to mind the store, as they say?
Right.
Yeah.
I lost someone very special to me, and in the aftermath of that grieving process, there were a few things I knew for sure, some things I'm not even sure I knew how to articulate before the loss, but mm-hmm. that refining process of evaluating all that you know to be true has left me with a few things that I could base my rest of my life on. And so I'm just wondering, and as you have gone through this grieving process, what are a few things that you know for sure now?
A few things I know for sure is, one, keep getting up and getting out. Don't isolate yourself. It's important to keep friends and family around you. And another thing that I think is really important is to stop talking about your loved one, to keep them in your daily conversation, to keep their memory alive, to look at pictures. Right after, it feels difficult, but it's really important. My daughter, Lisi, did something of her own imagination. She sat down a week or so after, and she started to write down things that Daddy said. She said, Mom, I don't want to forget things that Daddy said. And she made a little book for herself. She was 14. How she thought to do that, I have no idea. I don't want to forget. And I think the other thing that is really, really important is that we stay social, and that you really lean on prayer and faith if you have it in your life. It's a really, really important component to giving you a moral foundation, I shouldn't say moral, I would say a faith foundation.
Right.
Because the hope in the reuniting, and the hope in that person becoming your angel, is what I believe, is very, very healing. And it gives you great peace if you have a source of faith to rely on. So those are the things I know to be true. And I do know that there's another side. There's the other side of this. We think life is linear. I heard someone say this, and this is not original thought, so I can't take credit for it, but I think I agree with it. We think there's the beginning, and then life in the middle, and then the end. But if you hang on, God will bring those ends together, and there's a rebirth.
Hmm.
And then the cycle continues. It's just one. It's a circle. It doesn't end. But people who don't have faith think that we none of us become nothingness. We evolve into something more. And so I feel Don's presence with me, and I know that for other people who have gone through loss, if you can just get still enough to know that those people don't leave us, they stay with us in another form. That's my belief.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the best love stories are the true love stories. And for those of us, for all of our listeners who love reading love stories, this is a true love story. And so we are so glad you could be on the show. Where can people find the book?
They can find it at Amazon.com, and it's also downloadable.
Yeah, great. Nita, thanks so much for joining us, sharing really such a personal story.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you talking about the book on your show today. I really do.
Absolutely. Blessings to you.
Thank you.
Both of us have suffered significant loss. We both lost our dads at relatively young age. My dad died of cancer when I was 8. Your dad a little later in life. And it's interesting to hear a wife story, a mom story, because I know that you and I both can relate to what our moms had to pick up and do after just a devastating loss.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that I certainly could resonate with her in saying, this is not, this experience is universal. You feel like you're the only one having it, but you look around and afterwards you see everyone else who has lost in a new way. I think that's what it means in Colossians, when we are comforted and now we can comfort others. I
right.
pray that she's someone now who knows how to comfort others in a way that people maybe didn't know how to do for her at the time. But, you know, when I asked her what it was that she knows for sure,
I was going to ask you.
I appreciated her comments about the grieving process, but I really meant more like, one thing I know for sure is that God is sovereign. And that I've been able to hang my hat on that truth, even in areas that have nothing to do with loss, as a result of having really wrestled with how and why did this happen, and then knowing at the end that he's enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I'm not sure I totally agree with her that she can feel his presence. I think she can remember who he was, and I think he's certainly now in the great cloud of witnesses. But,
Yeah.
When someone dies, they don't really like hang out around here and we can feel the presence. Here's to hoping
in a psychological way.
Yes.
We are comforted by remembering them, by, you know, sort of knowing what that person might say. We can anticipate perhaps a conversation sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, Randy Alcorn has written a ton about heaven.
Yeah,
and lots
great
of folks, you know, who write about heaven have different theories about whether or not there's this metaphorical window and they can see what's happening. And it's certainly comforting for us to think that they know what's going on in all our best moments.
Right.
And it's really comforting.
I want that window to close a little bit when I'm not doing so well. It's like, I hope they can't see that part.
But I do believe that he tells us in Hebrews that there is that cloud of witnesses that is cheering the rest of us who are in this phase of our life experience on to do the right thing on a regular basis.
And it's a tough thing, I imagine, but probably a very therapeutic thing for Nita to write the story, her love story. I mean, part of that, I'm sure that we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but part of that grieving to grace process was probably just the ability to look at old pictures that she's included in the back of the book and to be able to write their story down.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cool thing. Even if you're not going to get your book published someday, I can imagine that's a great process for anybody who's going through grief, is just to write down that memoir of what it was like to be with the person that you loved and some of your thoughts through the grieving process.
And to be able for the next generation to know that the person that you're grieving was, you know, three-dimensional and had all sides to them.
Yeah.
And we have quite the story to share.
Yeah. Hey, we'd love to give you some free stuff,
absolutely,
by the way.
Absolutely.
You know, talk about an abrupt change. We've only got about a minute left, but
grieving to free stuff.
That's right. So, but Christina Ellis was on about how to win free money. We'd like to give you some free books.
Amen.
So, you know, check out our Facebook page.
Make a comment.
Real Life with Beth and Rob. Make a comment there about something that struck you on the show today or whatever. We'd love to send you. We'll pick a random winner and we'll send them a copy of the book. I mean, how easy is that? You just got to like share what it is that you're thinking.
I know.
In a sentence or two or several paragraphs. We don't care. And we will be glad to send you a book. And that's true for any of our shows.
Yeah.
And so, hey.
Find us on social media.
That's right. Find us on wherever, you know, our
we'd
web
like
page.
To inspire conversation. Right. You're going to go take this book. You're going to tell people, hey, I won something for free, and this is what it says.
That's right. You know, I hope people like the show because I just find it interesting. So basically, we just talk to people we find interesting. We hope you find them interesting, too. So.
Star Search Grand Champion.
That's right. And guess what? Next week, we're going to do it again.
I can't
Next
wait.
Next Saturday, 10 o'clock Eastern. You know, 7 o'clock Pacific. We'll be right back here, same station. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob.
Talk
and we'll be back next week. Until then, have a great day.